Greetings, listeners. Welcome to the Cold Fusion Now podcast, where we bring you the latest developments in the science and engineering of Cold Fusion Lenner. I'm your host, Ruby Carrot. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Michael McCoubre, former Director of Energy Research at SRI International, previously Stanford Research Institute, where there continues an almost 30 years program of experimental research in Lenner cold fusion. He's semi-retired to New Zealand in March 2016 and is currently consulting informally with several international research groups. Welcome, Dr. McCoubre.
Thank you very much, Ruby.
Dr. McCoubre, you have led a large experimental research program on Lenner for many years. What were the most difficult experimental challenges, and why were they so troublesome?
I'm basically a measurements guy. You know, my entire career from master's thesis, PhD onwards was developing new kinds of instrumentation, better instrumentation for difficult things, not incredibly difficult things, but just making measurements better. So for me, cold fusion was a wonderful opportunity, really, to explore a measurement space. And the first thing that I hypothesized, was that if Martin and Stan were correct, that deuterium somehow underwent nuclear reaction inside palladium, necessarily by different means than this reaction in free space, then the deuterium concentration in the metal ought to be important. And very few people were focusing on that at the time. I remember the first lecture I gave at an electrochemical society meeting, I got up and listed, you know, half a dozen or more ways that you could use to measure the deuterium loading inside palladium, and wondered why people weren't using them, including Martin and Stan. So what we contributed at that time, and I was very lucky that I'd spent about 10 years of my life up to that point, before March 1989, measuring deuterium inside palladium with a resistance ratio measurement. We were using this for the conventional nuclear industry. Hydrogen is important, and we happened to be working with the CANDU reactors, Canadian deuterated water reactors. So I'd been measuring deuterium in palladium for 10 years before I ever heard of Martin Fleischmann's efforts and results in cold fusion. So we knew how to do it. So the one of the things I'm most proud of, I suppose, is simply bringing that tool to bear on the problem of low-energy nuclear reactions, specifically the Fleischmann-Pons heat effect. So we learned how to calibrate the resistance ratio loading method into the regime of loading that I thought would be necessary, or hypothesized would be necessary, to produce the effect. Necessarily, this was a high loading regime because that material had been well studied at low loadings without any evidence of excess heat or nuclear anomalies. So pretty much necessarily, if Fleischmann and Pons were correct, then the regime of loading that was important would be the high loading regime. How could we measure that loading in situ? And really the first 2 years of effort, I suspect that about 50% of that effort was spent simply on that topic. How do you make high loading? How do you achieve high loading, and how do you measure that loading? And then obviously, more interestingly, is that loading associated with the excess heat effect? We also brought calorimetry into, I laughingly say, the 20th century, but calorimetry is sort of a medieval discipline it wasn't ever used or had rarely been used in the way that Fleischmann and Pons needed to use it, that is to make accurate measurements with modest precision over very long periods of time. Normally, calorimetry is done, you calibrate it, you know, hour one, you perform the experiment at hour two, you calibrate it at hour three, you take a linear interpolation between these two calibrations and say that's real. You don't need your calorimeter to sit honestly reporting for months on end, which is what the Fleischmann-Pons heat effect required. So we dragged calorimetry kicking and screaming into the 20th century, made it digital, and designed a first principles calorimeter that was insensitive to the system, the sources of systematic error that we could anticipate. So it was a very, very stable and accurate object, necessarily quite slow and clunky, but it was a first principles device that did not require calibration. So arguments made that, oh, your calibration's changed, you didn't see any heat, you've simply had a calibration hiccup, it could not be leveled at our calorimeter, and it was insensitive to a number of other effects too. People tend to forget that, but the power of our calorimeter was it was slow and stupid. And sometimes slow and stupid wins the race. At least we could trust the numbers that came out of it and communicate them easily. I remember I gave my the president of SRI a tour through the lab once, and I said I designed my calorimeter to be sufficiently simple that I could explain it to my 12-year-old daughter. And he clearly didn't understand my explanation. And as he left the room, I heard him speak to his guests and say his daughter must be very smart. But, she is, but it really wasn't that complicated a beast. It was designed really with the purpose of communication in mind.
And, you know, that's very important because measurement is everything in this field. And you used your own design calorimeters throughout this years of research. What would you say are some of the most important findings that you discovered using this equipment that you and your lab designed? And what impact did these discoveries have?
Hard to judge the impact, of course. I guess we're all waiting with bated breath to find out what the impact will be. But I have a list of things that SRI contributed that I'm proud of and would like, you know, to put forward. And we did postulate and demonstrate the importance of deuterium-palladium loading in achieving the Fleischmann-Pons heat effect. And in fact, at ICCF 3 in Nagoya, I stood up and presented a graph of the trigger effect, the initiation effect of loading on excess heat. It was a parabolic curve where excess heat appeared above a loading of 0.875. I gave the first paper of that conference. The second paper was given by Keiji Kunamatsu of IMRA, Japan, Institute Minoru Research Avancé in Hokkaido, Japan. And Kunamatsu presented exactly the same results. We were working quite independently.
Wow.
I didn't know of his work. He didn't know of mine. But it was really stunning to see your findings confirmed. Mm-hmm. You know, in the very next talk, we discovered a number of other things. Something which has been probably not as well acknowledged as should be is there is an initiation time delay in the Fleischmann-Pons heat effect. And Fleischmann and Pons knew this. John Bockris knew this. Early workers in the field knew that you wouldn't get an effect. Even if you'd loaded deuterium into palladium to very high levels and and shook it about as hard as you could, you would not produce the effect until some other process initiates inside the palladium metal. And for bulk palladium that we were using at that time, 3 millimeter diameter palladium wires, the initiation effect is 200 or 300 hours. So you just have to sit there and wait. And we still don't know exactly what that initiation process is. What it did mean, of course, is that a lot of the people that did quick experiments and did not see any anomalous heat effects, most of them can be explained by not having loaded well enough. The rest of them can be explained by not having waited long enough. So patience, our measurements taught us patience, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Michael McCubre, can you explain why it is that all the data on Lehner is not convincing to other scientists or the public?
Well, it is convincing once you can get people to listen. You know, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. That's probably not a perfect metaphor, but I don't think I've ever made a presentation or had a one-on-one conversation with somebody, groups of somebodies, and come away with them not believing that the evidence teaches something. They may not be convinced that it's fusion. They may not be convinced that it has the potential to be an energy source for mankind. They may not even be convinced that it's nuclear, but pretty much anybody that looks at the evidence, and the evidence, as you know, is thousands of published papers. You know, hundreds of meetings have been held on this topic, hundreds of thousands of hours work done and reported. So the evidence is pretty good. It's not in the best shape it could be. Not all of the experiments were as clear as they could be, and our publication record is incomplete, but contained within it is enough information for an open-minded person to acknowledge that something is going on that is not taught in nuclear physics. But therein lies the greatest hurdle to convince an entire group of people that their teaching is incomplete. Of all people, the physics community really doesn't want to hear that. It's human nature. You know, somebody comes up to you and says, I can do your experiment better, I can interpret your data better, and you've spent, you know, all of your career and all of your life developing this knowledge and mindset, and somebody from left field comes and tells you that you're wrong. We all of us react negatively. So we have to make our evidence clearer. We need to have unmistakable and irrefutable scientific proof that nuclear effects take place in condensed matter by mechanisms different from reactions in free space. It's a very big statement. Fleischmann and Pons discovered something much more important than cold fusion. They discovered condensed matter nuclear effects that had hitherto been undreamed of, except in the Mossbauer effect. The fact that nuclear processes can and do take place in condensed matter, in the solid state and very probably in the liquid state, by mechanisms with branching ratios and at rates differently from those same reactions in free space, that's a huge statement. It's going to take a severe rethinking of our understanding between the relationship between the nuclear and subnuclear particles and the electronic space, which is, you know, mm-hmm. chemistry and materials. Those two domains are linked. By shaking the chemistry, we can shake a nuclear effect. This was unthought of, unheard of. I think we need to do more than make evidence that there is a nuclear effect. I think we need to show that we can make practical use of the energy so created. I know there are two halves of this. The scientific question, is condensed matter nuclear science really science? And there's the practical question, can this thing that Fleischmann and Pons discovered be used to create a primary energy source? That is obviously the holy grail. And if we're going to make an assertion that that is possible, we need to give better evidence than we presently have. None of the work that I did at SRI could ever have been engineered as an energy production process. And we were producing at most 30% excess energy. As a nuclear statement, that's huge. As an energy statement, that's pathetic. In order to have enough free energy to overcome the Carnot barrier and then do something with that energy, you need gains of 10, let's say, 10 times more heat coming out of your experiment than the electrical power that you're putting into it. Mm-hmm. There have been a few experiments that have had such gains, in particular the experiments performed by the Israeli group, well, they're a New Jersey group, but
Energetics Technologies.
Yeah, ETI. So mm-hmm. ETI, and I consulted with them and worked with them for a year. Two beautiful experiments. One of them was demonstrated, or shown, discussed at ICCF 10 in Cambridge, Massachusetts, by Arik Elbaher, and he had a plasma discharge experiment that had a gain of something like 6. Mm-hmm. And a famous ETI 64 performed by the same group in Israel had a gain of 27.5. If that experiment just by itself, and it boiled the water in the calorimeter, so if that experiment just by itself could be replicated and sustained, we could use the heat to create electricity to fuel the experiment to make it self-sustain, as Jean Maloff was always so fond of dreaming, and you could make the prototype of a practical energy device. It's important to recognize that those experiments both used Dardic's superwaves, right? It's simple DC electrochemistry doesn't do it. You have to achieve high loadings and then shake the system in as many ways as possible in order to produce the Fleischmann-Pons heat effect. It's a non-equilibrium effect.
What needs to be done to solve this mystery? What experiments need to be performed that will lead to breakthrough and a new energy technology based on Lehner?
Well, this is a theme of my current thinking and the subject of a talk that I gave recently in ASTI at Bill Collis's ASTI workshop. But mm-hmm. I think that if you want to prove nuclear, tritium does the job. The tritium evidence is, I hesitate to say overwhelming in that not everybody is overwhelmed, but and I wasn't when I first heard it. But the fact is, tritium is produced in these experiments sometimes. The amount of tritium is not commensurate with the excess heat production and doesn't even seem to be closely correlated with it. It may, in fact, be anti-correlated. But the fact is, if you can make tritium in an electrochemical experiment, then nuclear processes take place in condensed matter by means differently from the way that these reactions take place in free space. It's a huge statement, and I think that demonstration can be clearly made. The people that did the work initially, Ed Storms and Carol Talcott and Bokris and his group, Srinivasan and the guys at Baba in India. Mm-hmm. Apart from Bokris, who is of course dead, but the rest of them are still around. The rest of them know how to do it. The rest of them can teach us how to make tritium, and they don't want to do it just as I don't really want to make heat anymore. You know, I know it. It doesn't teach me anything to produce heat at the same levels that I've done it before. And I did that. My heat measurements were done in the simplest calorimeter I can conceive of, with error sources that are clearly exposed, and yet we produced a statistically huge effect, something like 90 sigma. So for me, the heat, doing the heat over and over again doesn't teach me anything. It has to be done bigger and better in order to convince the outside world, which is why I suggest that we make a demonstration object, you know, that produces, say, 10 watts of heat, 1 watt of which can be used in addition to supplying the electricity that's needed to run the experiment. So a self-sustainer that sits there at the 10 watt or 20 watt level. Nuclear, it needs to be tritium. Those two things can be done in parallel. But the other thing, of course, that would be critical to the development of any technology is a more or less complete, or at least working, theory. It is simply irresponsible to scale up a known nuclear effect without any physics to underpin and understand the process, right? We're scaling into territory that we don't understand. We must have a theory. So I exhort the experimentalists to work harder on doing good experiments, understanding all of the input channels, understanding all of the output channels, publishing it clearly, and feeding this information to our theorist friends.
Dr. Michael McCubre, what are you working on right now?
Well, my principal mission, I suppose, and I'm semi-retired and comfortable and have the advantage of being able to be reflective. I think within the community, it's almost certain that the community has the knowledge needed to push this effects to the next level. Individually, we don't have the answer, but collectively, we certainly do. And my hope is that we can get a better coming together of minds, that people, you know, me-ism, I think, is a problem. You know, I did this, or I'm going to get this credit, or I'm going to get this Nobel Prize, mm-hmm. or whatever it is. It's really, we have to start thinking much more as a collective, talking to each other, communicating, like genuinely communicating, understanding what is real and what is not real. And unfortunately, we've all been doing it long enough, or so long, that knowledge has become entrenched in our heads that may not be actually right. And we've started to develop the same problem that the physics community has. There's something that they know just ain't so. And something that we think we know may not be so, and may be disrupting our progress. So it's not only important to learn, it's important to unlearn. And I may have been as guilty as any of pushing sort of simple truths. Excess heat is proportional to the loading above a certain loading threshold, which is certainly true for 3 millimeter wires and experiments performed at 30 degrees centigrade. But 30 degrees centigrade is not a useful temperature for heat generation. What happens at 300 degrees centigrade, for example? What is the role of loading? Is loading the important term, or is chemical potential what is important? And if it's chemical potential, what's important about chemical potential? Is it because chemistry does something inside the lattice that allows the nuclear process to take place? Does chemistry or mechanical effects produce Ed Storm's nanocracks, for example, or point defects, or whatever it is, whatever the nuclear active environment is within the palladium lattice, What is it that the deuterium is doing, providing other than being simply a fuel? And I do believe it's a fuel, but I don't believe that's its only role. So there are huge numbers of things to do. What we really, really need is for this to be normal science. You know, we need to do whatever experiments it takes to get mainstream science on board, so that instead of a few tens of us, or at most 100, we've got 10,000 of us or 100,000 of us working on this problem, then the problem gets solved.
Well, Dr. McCubre, we wish you success in your research, and thank you for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Ruby.
We've been speaking with Dr. Michael McCubre, former Director of Energy Research at SRI International, about the experimental science of cold fusion LENOR. He's currently consulting with several research groups internationally, and his work can be found in the Journal of Condensed Matter Nuclear Science and in the LENOR Library at lenr.org. Be sure to mark your calendars for the next International Conference on Condensed Matter Nuclear Science, ICCF 21, being held in the Laurie Student Center at Colorado State University in Fort Collins, Colorado, U.S. The conference runs next summer, June 3rd through the 8th, 2018. For more information and registration, go to www.iccf21.com. Find new episodes of the Cold Fusion Now podcast at www.coldfusionnow.org and on iTunes. Until next time, I'm Ruby Carrot.